This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast.
Today, we'll be speaking with Professor Karandeep Singh of the University of Michigan Medical School, where he is Assistant Professor of Learning Health Sciences, Internal Medicine, Urology, and Information. He directs the Machine Learning for Learning Health Systems Lab and has done a lot of really great work building models that improve health outcomes, as well as evaluating them and understanding what is required to actually make them useful in practice.
That's great. This sounds somewhat similar to some of the subject matter we covered with Professor Suchi Saria of Bayesian Health a few episodes back.
Yes. And in fact, we'll also start this conversation talking about sepsis alert systems. So before the interview with Professor Saria, we mentioned a paper from June of last year that showed that a sepsis alert system from the EHR provider Epic performed substantially worse in practice than had been reported. And Professor Singh was the senior author on that paper. We'll also talk about some models that Professor Singh sees a lot of promise for, and some of the organizational structure needed to effectively get new tech into the clinic. And so to frame our conversation now, I think it will be really helpful to get into the weeds of model drift.
Let's do it. What is model drift?
So model drift is the tendency of model performance to degrade over time after it's put into production. And there are all sorts of reasons that this can happen. So we'll walk through this paper, The Clinician and Data Shift in Artificial Intelligence, that Professor Singh is an author on, and Professor Saria and Professor Isaac Kohane, who we also spoke with this season, are also on that paper.
Small world. And what's that work about?
So basically, the paper outlines some examples of data set shift and then offers recommendations for recognizing and mitigating that data set shift. And of course, the authors make a point that the list isn't exhaustive, but it's pretty darn thorough.
All right. So let's start with the high-level structure.
Okay. So the authors divvy up the responsibility between an AI governance committee at the institution, the AI systems developer, and then the frontline clinicians. And the AI governance committee should be a multidisciplinary team that understands the AI and also understands the clinical use case. And then they'll partner with the system developer to create processes that monitor the AI's performance and detect harmful data set shift.
Got it. So for this relationship alone, we'll need quite a good bit of communication and resource investment. So as I understand it, a lot of AI vendors still just clear an algorithm with the FDA and then ship it.
And hospitals will have to continue to ramp up their organization to execute this, and AI vendors will too.
And where do the frontline clinicians come in?
Yeah, so the authors argue that safe deployment also requires vigilant clinicians. So they'll be responsible for noting misalignment between the model's predictions and their judgment. They'll keep in mind anything in their practice that's atypical or that's changed, or any IT and software changes that may have slipped through the cracks.
It'll be interesting to see what institutions can do to get clinicians on board. There's been quite a bit of frustration from clinicians being asked to monitor malfunctioning AI systems, especially since they already have so much flagging and documentation to take care of.
Yeah, completely. So like for these things to work long term, you need a lot of buy-in, and that's not going to happen overnight.
And when we do have that buy-in, what do we think the relationship between the frontline clinicians and the AI governance committee should look like?
The idea is that there should be an easy process for them to report concerns to the governance committee, which will then undertake a more formal review process. And the committee should also provide feedback back to the clinicians so that they know how their concerns are actually being handled.
All right. So in a sense, the committee is acting as a middleman between the clinicians and the AI vendor.
Basically, yeah.
Okay, so I'd love to walk through some specific examples. What might cause data set shift? How can we detect it and what can be done?
So one cause of data set shift are changes in tech upstream of the model. So maybe a new scanner model or a new EHR system. A new EHR system might have new variable definitions, and that could throw off the whole model.
And what should we do about that?
So ideally, the governance committee has put in place protocols to flag any IT changes. And there could also be quite a bit of manual work. So for example, for a new EHR system, they're recommended to review all the variable mappings that could be affected and then monitor afterwards for any changes in model performance.
And what about the frontline clinicians?
They should flag changes like data acquisition protocol, also pay attention to changes in EHR variable mapping, and as always, keep an eye on whether models just seem to have changed behavior.
Right. And what if the models have changed behavior?
In the case of variable changes, first a root cause analysis to see if there are any clear mismatches. Otherwise, model retraining.
So it sounds like regulation will have to get more sophisticated to handle these procedures. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely.
And this is only one source of data set shift. Seems like there is a potentially huge amount of work.
Yeah. We've never said on the podcast that moving AI from research papers into hospitals is easy. And of course, this paper offers a list of recommendations, but it definitely remains to be seen how these responsibilities will be divvied up in practice.
All right. And what are some other potential sources of data set shift?
Changes in population and setting is another big one. Are there changes in patient demographics or in the clinical setting, like a move from inpatient to outpatient? Are there new standards of care or changes in disease incidences?
Yeah, this makes it clear that we need to take into account all of these different sources of data set shift to be able to effectively deploy and monitor algorithms. Today with Professor Singh, we will talk about some of the benefits we've already seen from AI systems, even when they're not performing perfectly, as well as many of the challenges. Karandeep, thanks so much for being with us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by directly diving into one of your papers, the question of which is, how accurately does the EPIC sepsis model, which is a proprietary sepsis prediction model implemented at hundreds of US hospitals, predict the onset of sepsis? I'd love to dive into your work in which you showed what I'll let you describe.
Yeah, you know, this is a very difficult task, and it's difficult for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is that sepsis in particular has not one kind of standard agreed upon definition. And beyond that, I think the reason predicting sepsis is difficult is that sepsis presents in a lot of different ways, and it's not 100% clear at what point you need to be able to predict sepsis so that you can intervene. So, you know, someone comes in with fever, someone comes in with a high heart rate, they kind of don't look well. You often, as a clinician, might say this person could have sepsis and, you know, draw labs, draw blood cultures, maybe even start them on antibiotics. Sometimes that person turns out to have something else, right? Other times it turns out that, no, this person does have bacterial sepsis. So a lot of the definitions that we use to figure out, does someone have sepsis, actually are not things that you can really use in real time. They're things that we use after the fact. So we look at and say, well, did they get antibiotics? And how long were they on antibiotics for? If someone presents with a sepsis-like syndrome, turns out they actually are having a heart attack, they might come in looking like they have a, you know, the diaphoretic, sweating, not looking good. Turn out they're having a heart attack. They go to the cath lab. You stop their antibiotics. So even though they looked like they had sepsis up front, they would, in many instances, turn out not to meet our definitions of sepsis after the fact. So a lot of the reason sepsis models actually exist is to help us figure out in real time who might actually have sepsis right now, with the idea being that, you know, if you truly miss sepsis or you're delayed in treating sepsis, that people have worse outcomes. With that kind of as background, what we tried to do was look at how well does the EPIC sepsis model, which is a sepsis model that we happen to be using at that time and others have used too, predict sepsis at our institution, but also within the context of the way that our institution's sepsis governing group, our sepsis committee, was actually measuring and quantifying like a time zero for sepsis. They were looking at a couple of different definitions. One definition they were using was, you know, step one Medicare definition, which has to do with basically it's really symptom driven, like fever. It's meant to be objective in the sense that it doesn't rely on practice patterns. It relies on kind of heart rate, fever, respiratory rate, SIRS criteria, these things that are signs and symptoms that people present with. But also they were looking at this other definition, which is this CDC definition for sepsis called the adult sepsis event definition. And they were looking at a composite of these two to see when are people septic and when can the model tell us that they are, you know, having sepsis. And basically, I think what we found really was that if you're trying to predict the onset of sepsis before that time zero, before you meet either of those two definitions, then the Epic sepsis model, at least at our institution, isn't super useful. That's not to say that it doesn't identify anyone that you would have otherwise missed, but it's not super useful. It captures about a third of patients, you know, in that time frame. But if you look in the handful of hours after that time zero, then it actually seems to do better. The error in the curve in that setting was much higher, upper 0.7s, when we look at that definition, as compared to trying to predict the onset beforehand. One limitation in our study was that we used this composite definition, which means that in some of those cases, people got on antibiotics, and that was why they met the definition. And other ones, they had the signs and symptoms of sepsis, and that's why they met the definition. So, you know, essentially, we weren't able to really clearly tease that apart. So one thing we tried to look at was, if we took your scores up until that time zero of sepsis based on that composite definition we used, and we said, you know, let's look at the few hours afterwards and see, did you actually get antibiotics anyway? And these are people who no alert was generated. This is a model running quietly in the background. So we're scoring patients real time, not showing it to anyone. And what we found is that, you know, the vast majority of patients, at least at our institution, who would have been picked up by the sepsis score would have gotten timely antibiotics kind of anyway. Where we're defining timely here is within the 3 hours afterwards. Now that said, you know, there is some wiggle room there. Some people argue if you can get it from within 3 hours to within 1 hour, there's still some benefit. So I think, you know, our paper was one that was surprising to some because it arrived at a different conclusion from kind of what a lot of the internally reported stuff has been from the vendor. Also, because even at our institution, if you look at the vendor calculation of performance, it's much more optimistic than kind of what we were finding, even at our own institution. That's kind of, I think, in a nutshell, what I would say is kind of what we found. I think why we found it isn't the end all be all here. I think there is, like, we looked at a single center, we looked at a single set of criteria, and there's still more work required. But I think it was one study showing that at least at one center with, you know, one set of clinically reasonable criteria, that the model performed worse than some might have expected.
I really like your description here because it brings to light one very important challenge with getting these systems to work nationally or internationally, which is differences in definition. And so I want to maybe pose this question back to you is there any hope for having systems where we have these different definitions for a hospital to actually work when we deploy them?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Ziad Obermeier has also argued that a lot of the reason that AI models may not work is that our outcome definitions aren't actually kind of gold standards there, even for imaging and on other things. I mean, I think, you know, some of his work has shown, right, that even for imaging, traditional imaging characteristics may not be able to classify pain, but the image itself can actually help you understand how much pain someone might be in. Like, I think he was looking at the knee pain. So, you know, as long as there is, you know, some variability across expert clinicians, the best you could do with AI is really get to a level where you have that same level of kind of performance that clinicians would do. So one thing he's advocated for, as part of his like Nightingale project is rather than trying to model expert definitions of things, to actually try to model long-term consequences like death, like other adverse outcomes, with the idea being that ultimately we're in it to minimize those things. But I think that is one approach to it, is to forget about gold standards and just say, let's model only those hard endpoints. But the reality of the matter is a lot of the things we're trying to predict are so upstream of any of those kind of endpoints that we're just not going to be able to build those models for another couple centuries when we have enough data to actually say, you know, something that happens like in childhood or that happens early on, that, you know, we can try to prevent things. But as someone gets older and older, and particularly in hospital-based things where there is mortality associated with those, or there are measurable adverse outcomes, disability, like that, you know, happen with illnesses, That might be one way to do it. I think sepsis in this case is unique in many ways because there is uncertainty even after the fact sometimes as to whether someone has it. There is a consensus definition called the sepsis 3 definition. And I think if we had to go back and do our study over again, we probably would have looked at that definition. But even though there's these definitional issues, these issues also apply to other things like predicting when someone goes to the ICU. On one hand, it's very clear cut. When they show up in the ICU is when they go to the ICU. But actually, there's a lot of upstream steps that happen even there. Someone calls for transportation. Someone calls for a rapid response. And, you know, even when you're evaluating something like someone getting sick in the hospital and going to the ICU, when that transfer to the ICU becomes inevitable is actually way before the person shows up in the ICU. It's usually when other stuff is happening where the team has recognized this is someone who looks like they're ICU bound. And for a model to be useful, it really would need to tell you something before that.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And I think you laid out the challenge here very clearly, because as we're thinking about these long-term outcomes, we're also going to get into confounding factors like who received treatment, who didn't receive treatment, and those as being related to the final outcome. I want to ask about what you're excited about in terms of your work right now. You think a lot about implementation of these tools in practice. Could you share a story with us about something that you're implementing in practice or trying to implement in practice? And we'd love to understand the environment surrounding that.
Yeah, so I think a lot about implementation of these models. And I think, you know, there's a lot of amazing work happening right now in all of the upstream stuff, building models that are explainable, being able to characterize how well they do, being able to characterize why they make the predictions they do. So I think there is a lot of very exciting stuff happening kind of upstream. And then I think as you get closer and closer to the bedside, you know, some of that work tends to fall off. A lot of stuff that gets published is never implemented. And a lot of the stuff that's implemented, you kind of start using it and then there's no closing of the loop to see, does it actually work? Did it actually achieve the intended outcome it was supposed to have? And that intended outcome doesn't have to be a patient outcome, right? That intended outcome could be, it made someone's day easier. Someone has to do less work. You know, someone's work is more streamlined. It removes the cognitive burden of having to take care of some task. So I'll share a couple of the things that we are doing right now. And I think, you know, tell you some of the things I'm excited about going forward. Although a lot of the work that we published has been on sepsis, you know, we've also been tracking a lot of the work in deterioration. So these are inpatient hospital deterioration models, models that predict who needs to get higher level of care, more attention. This, I think, is an exciting area because there was a, you know, really nice paper by Vinny Liu and Gabriel Escobar published in the New England Journal a few years ago showing that implementing a deterioration model actually improves mortality. They did this at Kaiser, rolled it out to, I think, you know, over a dozen hospitals and were able to show that, you know, you can actually reduce mortality through this mechanism. And I think, you know, a lot of hospitals also have deterioration indices. We had published on the Epic Deterioration Index during the initial kind of COVID surge, finding that, you know, it has a high error in the curve and may play a limited role if you had to use it for triage decisions. But I think some of our more recent work has really been around, you know, how could it possibly streamline workflow? And I think one way in which it could streamline workflow is that we have a team of nurses in the hospital whose entire job it is to figure out if someone needs to go to the ICU and help them get there. And that's our rapid response teams. Pretty much every hospital in the US has a rapid response team. They are usually ICU trained nurses, you know, who can help stabilize a patient, do all the things needed to get someone safely from any part of the hospital to the ICU. You know, they'll respond to codes in the hospital. If someone says, you know, I need this person a heart stop, you know, we need to start CPR, do all the stuff. You know, you call a code, they are part of the code team that often will show up and help. But when there's no code being called, at least at our hospital, they're not just twiddling their thumbs. They're actually trying to go check in and proactively see where can they offer help. And that used to be, I think a year ago, 2 years ago, a manual process. They'd be calling out to floors and say, hey, do you have anyone who we should check in on? What do you think? You know, they might physically be walking around the hospital just to be visible so that if someone isn't quite at the point where they need a rapid response or a code, but there's just like a question, like this person doesn't look right. You know, we need to get an arterial blood gas, get some work up and see what's going on. That's where, you know, they might be able to intervene even earlier and just provide an additional hand to the floor nurse who's trying to do that in addition to take care of other patients. So what we have been doing for the past several months at our hospital is using a deterioration score to actually guide who they should round on. So every morning they look at who are the top 20 sickest patients at our hospital. And when they have downtime, they'll check through their charts. They'll call out to nurses. They'll physically walk around and see people. And that's something where the hope is that in the long term, we'll get some benefit out of that in terms of reducing mortality. In the short term, it's very hard to know what to measure. Do you measure that someone avoided the ICU? That's one way that the model could be useful. Maybe the model is useful because they got to the ICU sooner. Like this is someone who was inevitably going to go to the ICU, but they intervened before they had a code, before a rapid response was called. So it's going to be very tough to figure out, does it work? But in the longer term, I think, you know, like in the Kaiser study, you know, if you have enough patients, you might be able to quantify some level of benefit. So our rapid response team have been using this. And what's really nice is that we have a lot of talented researchers in our health system and in our university more broadly. So we've been able to do head-to-head comparisons of different models that are available that have been built by our researchers or available in the literature versus models that are available from our electronic health record vendor. And the one that we're using right now for the rapid response teams for the past several months was a model that was published recently in the British Medical Journal. This is a model developed by a team of researchers out of our university. It's called NCures. It was validated at three other health systems besides ours. I think UT Southwestern, Mass General, UCSF. And while what's cool about it is that it works really well, I think in some ways what's cooler about it is that we actually have it implemented. So again, many folks are building models, many folks are publishing. We've got these great models that work. And I think what's been great is that we've actually been able to hand those models off to the point where they're implemented, they're independently checked. Like I've done a bunch of separate analyses against that model. And now we're looking at how well does it do on the, you know, on the surgical units, how well does it do on the medical units? We can get into the nitty gritty of things that we have to do on the implementation side that will never make their way into a paper. But that's actually what we're using today. So I think a complete story of something that arose as a need during the pandemic, was developed over the course of several years. You know, it wasn't trained only in COVID patients. It was trained in non-COVID patients. We find that it works well in non-COVID patients. And so it's actually the one that we happen to be using today. But with all that said, we know that models can stop working over time for a variety of reasons. The biggest one in my mind being that many of these models, what's not unique is that they, you know, are really flexible, like neural network, XGBoost models. What's actually unique nowadays is many of these models, in order to be useful, take a look at practice patterns as part of their prediction process. So a physician prescribes something, that prescription indicates risk of something else happening and actually might be something that drives the score to go up to drive downstream risk. But what happens is if you test a model in one hospital versus another, or today versus a year from now where the guidelines might shift, how soon that physician prescribes that medicine might change, that medicine might go out of favor. And so the same patient who still has a high risk of the outcome might start to look lower risk because that same medication is no longer being prescribed in favor of something else being prescribed now. And so I think algorithmovigilance, as it's been described by many, I think is an interesting thing. And so one of our focus areas, I think over the next year, is really on getting us to a point where we have almost an industrial engineering manufacturing look into our models. Like models are starting to drift off course. Like essentially it generates a list of to-do items for our clinical AI governing body for our health system.
I definitely want to dive more into model drift, but just very quickly to tie a bow on the implementation side. You know, you mentioned that often researchers will have a hard time or they'll build models that actually never make its way into the actual clinic. And you have obviously done that very successfully. Can you maybe talk about the stakeholders involved in doing that? Like, how do you take a model from research to the clinic on a very practical person-to-person basis?
Yeah. So I would say we're still figuring it out, but I'll share kind of what some of the key resources are. So I think one thing culturally is that particularly for health system or hospitals that are linked to, you know, university researchers in some way, whether at that institution or through some affiliation, there is almost a complete cultural divide and mismatch and, you know, lack of overlap between the folks building these models and the folks who have a say over what gets used.
In what way?
So as an example, we have a talented set of researchers in the College of Engineering building, you know, models that might be very useful to us in the health system. By and large, at most health systems, there is a chief medical information officer. And that person usually oversees a set of informatics-oriented folks who have a say ultimately over, you know, what tools get used, not just models, but also things like what pop-ups can come up. What decisions do we make around our electronic health record, around, you know, how we collect this information or how we display this information? So there's almost a complete disconnect. One is usually a set of medically trained folks with an interest in informatics and essentially accountable to their medical folks. So how do you get those two people in a room together? And I think there are a couple different ways that we've done it. So I think one thing is that every health system needs some place that AI is governed. And what I mean by that is, hey, someone, you get a request, whether it's from a startup, whether it's from a researcher, or maybe it's from one of your physicians, or it's from the sepsis committee. We need a model to do X, Y, Z, or we're having trouble. We want to fire alert when someone has sepsis, but we know that it's not as simple as building a set of rules. You know, we want to implement a risk score. How do we do that? And I think up until 2018 at Michigan Medicine, we didn't really have an organized approach to handling that kind of request, whether, again, it be from a researcher or whether that be from like someone with a clinical operational need to improve quality care. So in 2018, our chief medical information officer and our now chief nursing information officer had the foresight to say, we would like a place for this to be governed. One of my predecessors, Fadi Islam, who's a nursing informaticist, recognized that there was an operational need for this because startups, other companies were approaching us and these requests were just going to all different parts of the organization. And there was no place for that request to get resolved. And so we established in 2018, a governing committee called the Clinical Intelligence Committee that is essentially, again, you know, responsible for reviewing these kinds of requests and essentially offering endorsement or not and helping teams think through these requests. And, you know, it's not just like, yes, no, it's like, okay, you want to do this. Before you can do this, you need to talk to that clinical group, to that nursing group. And only when they have agreed to it, can we really act on it. So it's helping people navigate the organizational processes to get things done, which I think previously there wasn't that handholding there where, you know, it felt like you wanted to do this and it was three levels away from what you can currently do. So there was almost seemed like there was no path to get there. So I think having this governing group helped. The other thing that has helped is we have a university-wide precision health initiative, and it's called University of Michigan Precision Health. That precision health initiative is essentially about getting research discoveries to the bedside. And so they actually have a, you know, data IT arm that helps researchers get the data they need, get the resources they need to build models. But they also have an implementation arm that essentially is about helping researchers get their stuff to bedside. And we have a roadmap for implementation. And so that roadmap involves getting you connected to clinical folks. It also involves helping you get your model packaged into a form that we can run in our cloud in a way securely behind our firewall so that that model that you built is something that we actually can use. And I think we're still building up resources around that process, but we've got a researcher-facing group called Precision Health. We've got a operations-facing group that's a representative of operations called this Clinical Intelligence Committee. And working in alignment, those groups, I think, you know, serving the needs of different people, the things that work for both are things that ultimately will make their way through the pipeline.
That's incredible. Is that common among health systems or is that very unique to your system?
It's not unique to our system. I have colleagues at other places that have, you know, maybe not identical processes, but some process around this kind of thing. Mike Pensina at Duke, who is, I think, inventor of the Net Reclassification Index from several years ago, he actually chairs their clinical AI governing group at Duke. NYU, I know, has some processes around this. I have colleagues at Tufts who are in the process of setting something up in along these lines. A colleague of mine at MGH is involved in some of the governing at Mass General. How they're set up is sometimes different at each institution. Like at some institutions, the same way you handle your decision support alerts is the way you handle prediction models. Whereas at our institution, we have two separate processes, recognizing that a lot of what we're looking at is very different for those two processes. Although sometimes a score generates an alert, and so it actually touches both committees, but we often will coordinate when that happens.
I'm curious what happens when you write papers that are specifically talking about models by vendors. So for example, the Epic Sepsis model that we were talking about earlier, are there any sort of political implications there when you start to kind of go after a vendor's model specifically? Like, Does Michigan sort of say like, hey, wait, please don't work on research like this because it might hurt our relationship with them?
Yeah, so I think anytime you work with anyone else's model that they've built, there's a certain level of healthy respect and like care you have to give because you're evaluating something that you didn't build. And as we know, a lot of research in machine learning, you know, has the word our model in bold and all of the column with all of those AUCs in bold because they're like an inch, like a millimeter better than the model sitting next to it. But it's a whole different story when you are evaluating someone else's work. And so I think the EPIC sepsis model paper, the EPIC deterioration model paper, some of the follow-up work, the work we did where we looked at sepsis scores during COVID and kind of how they changed during our first wave of COVID, not just at our hospital, but actually across 24 US hospitals working with three other health systems. A lot of that work did not happen in a vacuum. It really happened through things that we were seeing on the ground as a health system and in our ways that we were supporting our hospital's sepsis committee. So I think it's one thing when, you know, you kind of are going out on a limb on your own, just looking at something, because I think you want to make sure that, hey, if you find something that this is something that you share with the developer of the model, this is something that you share back with, you know, your institution so that you can decide if we need to make any operational changes in response to this information. So for the EPIC deterioration model, when COVID happened and we looked at that one, I think, you know, we were very open about what we were doing. We actually shared all of our underlying code, all of our, you know, R notebook and output, pre-printed our paper and published it, I think like a year later. So I think with that one, we were, again, extremely outwardly open, transparent, and anyone can verify our code. And other groups have actually used our code since to look at other models that they're building. With the sepsis model, we actually met with data science colleagues from EPIC a few months leading up to before our paper came out. I think it was maybe about 2 months before the paper came out. I shared with them our primary findings. I think it's a mixed bag because on one hand, the model looks worse than what is reported. On the other hand, there are some patients that you pick up with the model that you otherwise would have missed. And I think one thing we weren't able to fit into the paper, because we actually had to cut our paper in half when we published it, was we had looked at net benefit. And actually, you know, it turns out that even at that level of performance we reported, the net benefit of the model is positive. And it's positive because, and this is, you know, using decision curve analysis, which is a toolkit developed by Andrew Vickers out of Memorial Sloan Kettering and colleagues of his to measure ultimately at the end of the day, is the model useful or not? And so for this model, it was positive, but it was positive predicated on the fact that you are willing to be alerted on anyone who is having 6% risk or more. What that says is you're willing to tolerate tons and tons of alerts if you're willing to be alerted anytime someone has 5 or 6% risk of sepsis. When we chose a threshold of 6, we didn't choose it because of that reason. We chose it because the numbers looked good on the sensitivity and specificity based on what was reported by the vendor. But I think, you know, if you were to go back and say, is that actually the level of certainty you'd want? Well, guess what? I mean, about 7% of our patients, I think, at Michigan Medicine have sepsis who are hospitalized. So I think 6% or more risk is essentially saying someone has average risk or more. Page me. So under that constraint, the net benefit was positive. But I guess what I'm saying is I shared the kind of complete set of results with them and said, here's the good, here's the bad. And I think they listened to it. They were cordial. And, you know, that was part of my process of getting their approval to share certain things about the model in our paper. You know, I didn't share the entire paper with them, but I did share with them key parts of the paper because even the predictors that go into that model are technically considered confidential. And so I felt like I really needed to engage with them, partly to be cordial and to make sure that they knew what we were up to, but partly because if I didn't get their permission, I didn't feel like I could publish anything about the model beyond what we found. I couldn't publish anything of the predictors that go into it. And so just to even share a summary of like how it was built, what it even is, I got their permission. And so I met with them back in April. Our paper came out in June. And yeah, I think it got a lot more attention than I was expecting, than I think probably they were expecting. And so anytime someone publishes something that's critical of your work, you know, you're going to look at it, but I think you're also going to push back a little. And so I think some of that's normal and natural. And I know that, you know, some ongoing work is being done to replace the current sepsis model with an updated version. And I think some of the things that we had suggested are things that I think they ultimately have chosen to implement as a best practice. So one thing we found in our follow-up was in COVID patients, we probably want to suppress alerts because in COVID patients, many of them, particularly in the first wave, were coming in with fever and high heart rate and high respiratory rate And those people didn't need antibiotics. They largely needed treatment for COVID, which we didn't have in the first wave, but we have now. So they have actually gone back and updated their best practices to say, hey, if someone has COVID, that you may want to consider at the institution level suppressing the alert. So I think, you know, some good has come out of that, but definitely I think because of the attention that it got and because it was a finding that was critical of some of that work, it is going to have implications. And I'm just really thankful that I think I have really supportive leadership in our health system. And again, you know, our chief nursing informatics officer, you know, her name is on that paper. The person who did the actual variable mapping for the model in our institution, their name is on that paper. So I think the idea was, is this was not a kind of a outside effort. It was really a concerted effort in trying to understand this, really in service to our sepsis committee. But then, you know, with the idea that if we're doing operations research in this, we should be sharing that operations research beyond.
I love it. Very cool. I'd love to go back to model drift. You had mentioned earlier that a lot of models that are implemented in hospital systems, there's never a closing of the loop. You know, people don't really follow up and actually see, did the model do what we expected it to do? Whose job is that? And when do you have to close a loop?
So 6 months after a model is being silently scored, our process has been to give an update on how well it's doing prospectively. So that's the first step. That's still silent where no one's using it, because we do know that there is some drop off in performance when you take a prepackaged model, even if it was validated retrospectively at your own institution, when you run it prospectively, it may do slightly worse or much worse, depending on constraints around infrastructure where certain variables couldn't get mapped or certain variables change their meaning in the prospective view. But then 6 months after folks start using it, we also ask them to come back and share an update. We haven't been super prescriptive about what it is they need to share. You know, it depends a little bit use case to use case. One, you know, rigorous thing that we had done at one point was, and this is outside of the Clinical Intelligence Committee, you know, this is a funded grant through Medicare, is we had done a randomized controlled trial to see whether identifying high-risk patients who are going to show up in the ER multiple times, so identifying those patients and offering them additional care coordination or case management to address housing needs, address other needs, could keep them out of the ER. And this is sometimes called hotspotting. You take people who are high risk based on hotspotting or predictive models, you intervene on them to try to reduce their risk, and then you look. And there's a whole literature in hotspotting where if you do before after studies, every intervention looks like it works just because of regression to mean. Like if you're showing up in the, you know, in the ER 20 times in a year, the next year, you can almost only go down. It's like very hard to go up from that. So we did a randomized controlled trial. And interestingly, you know, we published one paper that showed our model performed reasonably well in terms of predicting, you know, who's going to show up in the ER multiple times. But then when you try to use that as a criteria for enrollment, you say, okay, now among the high-risk people, let's randomize half of them to an intervention, half of them to, you know, a delayed intervention where next 6 months they're going to get usual care. We found no difference in outcomes. And one of the reasons was that our intervention involved calling people to offer them resources. And as you know, when people get a phone call from a number they don't recognize, they don't pick up. And that's even more true when someone is potentially homeless, when someone is potentially vulnerable. You know, like I don't pick up from numbers I don't recognize. That's even more true, I think, when you are marginalized than if you have access to resources and feel like a part of your community. So I think that was an instance where we, you know, we model was good, intervening based on the model wasn't useful. And, you know, so we ultimately stopped using it because we felt like, yes, even though we can find that population, our intervention isn't effective enough where it can help. And that's one key thing is you might have a perfect model. And if your intervention is doing nothing, you know, if your intervention is, you know, some medication that's like a vitamin and it has no real benefits to whatever it is that you're trying to manage, then your model could be as good as it wants. You have to have a useful intervention for the model to be of any use. To answer your question, that's kind of a story where we found that the model was good and the intervention wasn't good, but our process has been to ask people to come back in about 6 months. And the challenge is that doing a trial takes resources. Even the most limited, lightweight, pragmatic trial still takes some level of resources. And I think we are still figuring out how to do some of that work, who should pay for it, who should subsidize it, because it is an operations need, but many health systems aren't equipped to do randomized controlled trials for all kinds of other things they implement to improve quality. So models are no exception to that.
I want to ask you about a different kind of model, which is your mental model now.
of the different stakeholders and the incentives that they have when you're trying to implement these things, take things from bench to bedside. What can you share about what you've learned about who different stakeholders are and what they're driven by in terms of saying, I'm on board, let's do this?
Yeah, great question. So many health systems, ours included, you know, has a tripartite mission. So we really trumpet the fact that, you know, we care about clinical care, first and foremost, we care about research, we care about education, because we have a medical school, we train people, we have a robust research setting where we have a lot of important research going on. And obviously, we are tasked with taking care of our patients. And so any kind of a request that makes it to our committee has to get prioritized. And so, you know, the institution has internal priorities for how to prioritize things that are in the IT realm. So I will say one thing, that although we have a tripartite mission, not all things are equal. So if we get five requests, not all of them would get implemented first, because we have to prioritize. And prioritizing is one of the things that governing is all about. But in terms of, you know, who are your stakeholders, to some extent, they are consistent across all of our use cases. But to another extent, they are ad hoc dependent on the use case. So an example I will give is that if you look at who's on our governing committee, it's our chief medical information officer. It's our chief nursing information officer. It is several of our associate chief medical information officers. It's several of our folks who are in charge of various aspects of our data in the electronic health record. It is folks who are in charge of quality and quality analytics, because ultimately, a lot of the reasons that might drive us to prioritize something is if we are not meeting some measure on quality, or we feel like we're falling short of where we need to be, that could be recognized as a priority. And that, again, then comes from, you know, the chief medical officer or the chief clinical officer. You know, those folks aren't a member of our committee, but through these other folks who have some reporting relationship up to those leaders of the health system overall, that informs who's an important stakeholder. And then we also have the application coordinators. These are the folks that actually write the code, help us do some of the wiring up of models, because their time is also really valuable. And when we're prioritizing things, we need them to tell us this is an easy lift, that's a much harder lift, so that we can take that into consideration. They have responsibilities outside of prediction models that they'll often have to handle also. So that's, I think, at the kind of pure operations level, who are the stakeholders that we have to balance the needs of. I think if we were missing the mark medically, you know, like we were super early adopters, not applying rigor, I think there'd be a lot of pushback from the medical side of things, because on the medical side, we're usually fairly conservative. We want to use things that work. We want to use things that have been tested. And that essentially informs a lot of the way that we operate, is, you know, that kind of conservative nature of making sure we're not doing harm before we implement stuff. Outside of our committee, we have other places in the hospital where things are governed. We have a CPR committee that is ultimately in charge of rapid responses, and any CPR that happens in the hospital, out of hospital cardiac arrest, is an important area. And then we've got a sepsis committee. We don't have a single quality committee. We have a quality department and quality embedded through multiple areas of the health system. So if we're talking about ER quality, there's a different person who handles that than if we're talking about inpatient quality or quality around specific types of surgeries or, you know, other things that we do. So I would just say, you know, a lot of what the folks in the room are there for is to help us just navigate, like, who needs to know about this? So that something comes into us and we're, you know, we can just draw a map of the org chart and say, who needs to be aware so that we are operating under kind of the usual processes of the organization? Like, we don't do the implementing. We know that we have a dyad or a triad of a physician and nurse administrator on most floors that handle the actual implementation. So that's who we need to engage if we're going to implement something on that floor. That kind of process is the stuff that we have to be aware of. Outside the health system, obviously, we have a robust university. And so there's folks in computer science, statistics, biostats, school of public health, medical school, college of engineering, school of information, developing all kinds of cool stuff that they want to see ultimately hit the bedside. And so in my precision health role, I view ourselves as the front door to the rest of the university. Like, you're doing something interesting, impactful, that could make an impact. Let's talk early. Let's talk now so that we can lay out what is a potential pathway to implementation, along with help from colleagues and other folks at our university.
That's awesome. I love the landscape that you've laid out here and built over time, because frankly, I think very few institutions can claim an understanding of how to go about governing and translating such things into practice. So certainly applaud you and your teams for that. Let's say someone came to you from outside of the institution or through one of these computer science or statistics department and said, I have a model for a clinical problem. What kind of validation would you want to see to say something is ready to loop in these different stakeholders?
I would say that, you know, ultimately, there's a chicken and egg issue because of differences in practice patterns, because of differences in populations. Something that works at one place works at one place. The other thing I like to, you know, kind of share is that when you're in the model developer's shoes, right, you think of internal validation and external validation. When you're in the model implementer's shoes, you think of external validation and local validation. So ultimately, it is great that a model works at, you know, 4, 5, 6 other places, but because of the brittle nature of a lot of these models that rely on a mixture of patient characteristics, practice patterns, and other things, you often do just have to run it silently and check if it works here. But if it works here, are we going to use it? We're not going to wait to do the silent evaluation to make that call. The first thing, if an outsider came, is I would say, you've got to find a clinical partner and champion. Because if this works, that's not the time to find a clinical champion. It's too late. Because very possibly that clinical champion could have told you something of what's important around timing of when it needs to work that might actually have affected how well it works here. So I think, you know, typically my process is if you were to come outside to us and we would say, find someone, you know, who like we would help you or, you know, work with you or suggest some names to people. And if you found traction, you found someone who actually wants to implement it, model built elsewhere, technically, it's not a heavy lift to do, then I think there'd be a process to go through to implement, with the idea being that the reason we're implementing is often either it's going to fund some kind of research or actually be used in patient care. And even then, one person may not be enough. I mean, if this is going to be something that's used in the ICU, they probably need to involve the ICU directors to say, hey, I'm going to work with this team to do this work. I want to make you aware so that if this thing works, I can then come back to you and share, you know, a status update. So we often do want to see it work here. We don't do that for every medical guideline. I mean, clearly, every medical guideline that comes out, we don't, you know, locally test and see, well, does statins work here? Does aspirin work here? But it's this more brittle nature of these kinds of models that when they're, even when they're regression models, can just simply be miscalibrated when you transfer them across institutions, or when they're deep learning convolutional neural net models, you know, like the recent work where it showed that it can predict someone's race out of, you know, chest x-ray. It's like, why would that be feasible at all? That doesn't make any sense why it would be able to do that. So, you know, I think we have to have a healthy level of respect for more complex models to know that we don't know exactly why they're, you know, making a specific prediction. But for simple models, I think miscalibration is so common. We've published over and over again, model works great at a primary care setting. When you apply it in a hospitalized setting or a tertiary care setting or in a specialty clinic, the model dramatically underestimates risk, or the other way around, where you build a model in tertiary care setting, roll it out to a primary care setting, and you find that, you know, the model greatly overestimates risk because its base rate it's used to seeing is much higher or lower than the base rate it's seeing now.
All right, that was great. Karandeep, thanks so much for being on the show with us today. This was super insightful. And thank you for being a champion of AI implementation, how to go about thinking about this process.
Thanks, Adriel. Thanks, Pranav. Appreciate you having me.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Professor Singh for being with us today. And thank you for listening. We're your co-hosts, Pranav and Adriel. And until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee, Mark Robbins, Ashwath Radhachandran, and Navami Jain. Music by Ethan H.E. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.